And our sermon text today are Psalms 1 and 2. Page 448 in your pew Bible. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. He is like a tree planted by streams of water that yields its fruit in its season. Its leaf does not wither. In all that he does, he prospers. The wicked are not so, but are like chaff that the wind drives away. Therefore, the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, "Let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us." He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. Then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury, saying, "As for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, 'You are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage, and the ends of the earth your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel.' Now therefore, O kings, be wise, be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way, for his wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are all who take refuge in him." Kings and music, they go together, don't they? I've been listening to a lot of Beethoven here recently. We just listened to his Ninth Symphony, his Kitchen Sink Symphony on the way in. Beethoven wrote several pieces of music for royalty, though he was thoroughly ambivalent about their inflated status in European society. My two favorite examples, Beethoven's Fifth Piano Concerto, the Emperor Concerto, it's called. Once again, I've been afflicting Debbie with this. Every time we go into market, I get going 55, 60, 65 miles an hour as the music picks up. The Emperor Concerto is a royal, majestic, grand in every way. I can easily imagine kings, David and Solomon, entering thrones to this music. And Beethoven dedicated it to his patron and pupil, Archduke Rudolf of Austria. Although this was the fashion in which art was supported during Beethoven's days by rich patrons, Beethoven often resented the way great artists had to defer then to them, including himself. He always considered royalty beneath him, a necessary evil for artists to create. Of course, the most famous example of Beethoven composing for royalty was his Third Symphony, the Eroica, considered one of his masterpieces, a groundbreaking in composition of symphonies, too. It was originally dedicated to whom? Do you know to whom the Eroica was originally dedicated? Yes, I see Napoleon on the lips of many of you. Yes, Napoleon Bonaparte. When Napoleon first burst on the scene, he was thought to be a democratic revolutionary, bringing the ideals of liberty, equality, and fraternity to all men. In fact, many wept, just as we saw with the coronation or inauguration of our recent president as well. He was going to be a deliverer. But when Beethoven heard that Napoleon had himself crowned emperor, when will our presidents be crowned emperors in open recognition of how they behave? When Napoleon had himself crowned emperor, he flew into a rage, Beethoven did. He seized the top of the page of his manuscript he was still working on, tore it off, and he rewrote the title the hero, or Eriakim, instead of Bonaparte. Beethoven said, he thinks himself superior to all men and has become a tyrant. Beethoven always felt that no king, no prince, no politician ever lived up to his music. None of them were ever good enough to merit the dedication he gave them. One of my favorite Beethoven anecdotes, too, is one where he and the great German author Goethe, they were contemporaries, were walking together in a garden at a party, chatting amiably about art, when they came upon several lesser royalty coming down the same path. There was not room enough for both of them. Beethoven remarked to Goethe, "We are artists and we should give way to no man, especially inbred royals." Now Goethe chose to defer and step off the path, while Beethoven stormed right into the middle of them, forcing them off the path. So when it came to kings, princes, and royalty, Beethoven's insistent question was, what prince merits the favor of the artist? Not what artist merits the favor of the prince. In the end, for Beethoven, no prince ever merited the favor of his art. My contention is that Beethoven never had in mind the true prince, the perfect man. People dispute about Beethoven's religion. He didn't have much of it, except for himself. He could have lived, I suggest, multiple lifetimes, composed numberless scores, and never gotten it right. No one, neither Archduke Rudolph, nor Napoleon Bonaparte, nor President Obama, how'd he get in there, can ever live up to the glories of his music. There's only one who does, too, I would submit to you. The one pointed to by our first two psalms here today. He is the one who merits the glory of all arts. Let us look then, because indeed these psalms were sung, were they not? If you missed our introduction to the psalms last week, I believe it's up online, and you can get my take on these psalms, where they go, what they do. They indeed were sung, were they not? Sung by not only the Levites, but the congregation, which is why we are singing them as a congregation too. So the first question that we ask is, who is righteous like God's man? Point number one, Psalm number one. Who is righteous like God's man? Here we are, book one, Psalm one. How many books are there? Books of Psalms, are there? I see one answer. Five, right, five. And this is book one, Psalm one, Psalms 1 through 72, book one. In fact, it's book one, Psalms 1 and 2. They go together. In several editions of the Hebrew manuscripts, there is no heading for the second psalm, and it's treated as a continuation of the first. But in any case, they were both sung together as coronation psalms. That is, psalms employed at the crowning of an Israelite king. Both were considered apropos for the inauguration of a new administration, in that wisdom and righteousness were necessary. They should characterize the judgment of the king, right? Hopefully. But of course, when you look at the history of Israel's kings, you see it's completely otherwise. Just take Rehoboam after the death of Solomon. Whose wisdom and counsel did he follow? The young bucks, right? Not the wizened advisors under Solomon. And then Psalm 2, of course, the universal extension of his power would eventually obtain for his reign. This was the hope. Yet we see, of course, in Israel's real history, just the opposite, right? The withering, the fragmenting, the division of the kingdom, and eventually exile. Well, what was the refrain for Jesus at the triumphal entry? Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. How does our psalm begin here? Blessed is the man. Asheri Haish. Blessed is the man. How does the Messianic Psalm book commence? Blessed is the man. How does the second Psalm end? Two. Drop your eyes down to the end of Psalm 2. Blessed are all who put their trust in him. So it's a nice compact sandwich, if you will. Beginning with blessing, ending with blessing. Another indication that these two psalms go together. The coronation of the king moves from the singular blessing of the man to the blessed state of all. That is, his subjects who take refuge in that king and his kingdom. Now, initially, this in the life of Israel, as these songs were employed, sung by the Levites and sung also by the congregation, initially this meant Israel and her king, David and Solomon, beginning with David and Solomon. But then, as you read through Kings and Chronicles, the wheels start to come off of Israel's destiny. The expectation was that another would come who would fulfill these words. And some of these men were utter disgraces too, were they not, to their calling. So as we move through the Psalms, and as we commence with these two, always keep in mind the banner that hung over the Psalms. That is the promise, the decree, as we'll get to. The idea that, as in 2 Samuel 7, the promise was, when your days are fulfilled, David, when your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring after you, who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom, singular. There would be a king whose kingdom would be established. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. They heard this. His kingdom would be established forever. They were looking for this king. The crowd that exclaimed Jesus upon his triumphal entry fully hoped that he was this king, did they not? And he was, wasn't he? He was, but he wasn't, too. He wasn't the kind of king they were pulling for. They were thinking they were going to get that would rule in a political kingdom throughout the earth. But he was, nevertheless, this king. And his kingdom is growing and spreading, is it not? Percolating, like the seed growing secretly, like the mustard seed starts out small. Throughout the earth it is now. Well, as Israel sang these psalms at the coronation of Rehoboam, for example, these psalms sung at the coronation of Rehoboam, well, they hoped that he would be the man. He would be the man. They found out already that Solomon wasn't, right? Solomon in his grave and loved women and horses. He was certainly not this king. Would Rehoboam be that man? He certainly wasn't, was he? Just tick through the kings of Israel and Judah. Uzziah, Ahab. Oh. Hezekiah, indeed a good king. Josiah, indeed a good king, but not the man. Look at what is expected here in these Psalms. Look at what is expected and what's delivered by those other kings. What was expected? Asheri Haish, blessed is the man. Followed by three negatives and two positives. Those three negatives. The man walks not in the counsel of the wicked. Notice the posture too, because the king would move through these postures on his way to his coronation. He would walk, he would stand, and then he would sit on his throne. The man walks not in the counsel of the wicked. Unlike Rehoboam, the good king's counselors, the man's counselors, would be wise. He would sit amongst the counsel of the old and the wise, not the young and the foolish. The man, as well, stands not in the way of sinners. Unlike Ahab, he does not practice the ways, that is, the deeds of sin that characterize life, of Jezebel. The example being the theft of Naboth's vineyard, right? And the man does not sit in the seat of scoffers, unlike Jehoiakim, who scoffed at the notion of Jeremiah's prophecy of judgment. Remember, he sat there in the winter by his fire, and as Baruch read the scroll from Jeremiah, the king would just slice off what he had just read and throw it in the fire. Scoffer! See the postures of government here as well. In everything that he does, as he walks and he approaches his coronation, he stands, is coronated, and then sits upon his throne. Walking, standing, and sitting. In every posture, the true man eschews wickedness, sin, and derision. It's meant to sum up those formal postures of a king, both at his coronation and during his rule. So, the man, the true man. Did you see the movie Truman? There's something in that name, right? True man. The true man is committed to two positives. Number one, his delight. I like that word. Good translation, too, of the Hebrew. His delight is in the law of Yahweh. This idea of delight expresses the fond expectation and joy derived from learning and practicing obedience to God's law. Remember, this was supposed to be the witness to the nations. The promise was, Moses said, the nations will look around and see this law and how it has blessed you and how you prosper. And they will want it too. That was supposed to be their witness to the nations. Their love of and adherence to God's law. How about you? Oh, but Pastor, we live under grace now and we don't need God's law. No, grace enables you to love and obey and embrace God's law with a zeal and a delight of David. Okay? Well, his delight is in the law of Yahweh, even as Christ delighted in the law. And he meditates day and night in it. Jesus spent long hours into the night, arose early to do precisely this, to meditate upon it. Josiah, once the scrolls were rediscovered, right? He said, he rent his clothes and said, oh my God, literally, right? What have we done? But he meditates in the law, Josiah does, such that he learned the law to obey it. Remember, we have the example of that careful practice of the Passover done in a way unknown in Israel's history. So, the man, the true man, then meditates day and night in this law. Parenthetically here, note with me this word meditate. Yehegah, Yehegah, is the same word found in chapter 2, verse 1, which is translated there as plot. This word has a wide semantic range. It can be translated either as meditate or plot, depending upon the context in which you find it, right? So another thing that ties these two psalms together is this idea that the righteous meditate upon God's law while the wicked plot against God and his law. The psalm then moves on to an apt ancient metaphor, a tree. Very simple illustration. Kings are often likened to trees as well, right? Nebuchadnezzar in his kingdom was likened to a tree. Well, so the king here is likened to a tree. What the true man eschews are three, but what he is like are four. Note with me. Number one, the true man is planted by streams of water like a flourishing tree. We know this in Idaho, don't we? In semi-desert Idaho, high desert, the most flourishing trees are found near sources of plentiful water. We'll see this image throughout the Psalms, the still waters, right? Sheep led by still waters as well. Unless you craft bonsai trees, then you want to torture trees. Abby can tell you all about that. Mike is, her husband Mike is fond of torturing trees. Get some beautiful specimens that way, but that's the life of a bonsai artist, huh? The true man finds plentiful resources for his soul as well in God's law, like a tree does by streams of water. Secondly, he yields its fruit in season. Well-resourced trees do that, don't they? We planted a plum tree. We're anxiously fretting over it this year. Well, I hope it survives the parched summer and the sparse soil. But in a few years, we hope to have some plums out of this tree. So the true man bears spiritual fruit from practicing obedience to God's law. Thirdly, its leaf does not wither. Life for the well-resourced tree goes on, and so does the spiritual life of the man who loves and practices God's law. And fourthly, his tree is prosperous. How prosperous the fruitful orchard, huh? Debbie's grandfather had an orchard. Her dad grew up in fruit orchards in western Michigan. Great place to grow fruit, western Michigan. Well, so the man who loves and obeys God's law. He is prosperous. Solomon was an early example of this. But then sustaining the flora image we have here, the wicked are contrasted as chaff that is blown away. They seem so mighty and so strong and so well established. Remember, the psalmist grieved his heart about this in Psalm 73 for the longest time. Then he went into the temple of the Lord and discovered indeed that the wicked will not stand. And a conclusion is drawn. Therefore, these will not stand in the judgments. Now, at a coronation ceremony for the earthly kings of Israel, kings held assizes on a regular basis. That is, they held judgment courts. And this is what is in immediate view. But of course, we see as well, with Christ on the horizon, we see that great judgment to come as well. That also comes into view and will come in larger view to the people of Israel as well, as they anticipated their eschatology. Okay? We'll anticipate our eschatology on Wednesday night, and we'll come across stuff like this. So, in a blessed kingdom, sinners would not be found amongst the congregation of the righteous, as the text says. That is, at the time, immediately, the festal crowds of Israel that would be gathered for the feast of Israel or special occasions like this coronation. But of course, it also anticipates the church when the great true man appears. Adam failed as that true man, didn't he? David, Solomon, Kings and Chronicles are a labor of examination. Sifting through the lives of the kings of Israel. Is this the true man? Is this the king that was promised us? Is this the one who will be like a flourishing tree, each and every one? No, no, no. All those crowned kings of Israel. Great expectations, right? Well, then who was he? Huh? Who was this true man? The man of the Psalms. This will be a theme, as I mentioned in our introduction last week. This will be a theme throughout the Psalms. The man, the righteous man, the true man. And it is only fitting then to sing of his kingship too, which brings us to point two. Who is sovereign like God's king? Who is righteous like God's man? We know. Who is sovereign like God's king? Psalm number two. Once again, what ties these two together is the perishing way of the wicked that's talked about here, which segues from the end of Psalm 1. The perishing way of the wicked is expanded here. While the true man meditates upon God's law, upon what do the wicked meditate? Once again, the same word, right? The righteous meditate on God's law. The others plot. They devise plots in concert with one another. They devise plots in concert with one another to do what? To obey? To submit? Nations do these things, do they not? Even as we speak, nations are plotting in Ukraine, right? Whether you're for Russia or for the combined forces of the West, nations are plotting. Nations are plotting in Syria, in Iraq. The Islamic State, as it's called, plotting to do terror here in America. Nations do these things, do they not? They plot. But they plot rather to throw off the rule of the righteous one. This psalm communicates just the opposite as well of the placid, meditative prosperity of the righteous. Peace, the shalom of God, is found upon the righteous in Psalm 1. But here, rather, we have raging turmoil, plots, devices, with kings and rulers set. That Hebrew word set there means it's a synonym of planted, that is fixed in their hearts to do evil and not change. Some men can be called back from their evil. They will repent of their evil. The man who has his heart set in the fashion the psalmist gives it to us here, who have their hearts set, are planted, fixed to do evil, and will not change. Whereas the true man takes counsel from the wise, these take counsel together against whom? Of course, the Lord and his anointed. Of course, ultimately, it is Christ, is it not? Peter points this out. Turn to Acts chapter 4 a minute. We preached through Acts not too long ago. And in Acts chapter 4, once again, this is apostolic preaching, isn't it? Apostolic interpretation. If the apostles can interpret the Old Testament this way, we should too. We can and should. About verse 23, you see Peter commenting here after his release from jail. When they were released, they went to their friends and reported what the chief priests and elders had said to them. And when they heard it, they lifted their voices together to God and said, "Sovereign Lord, who made the heaven and the earth, the sea, and everything in them, who through the mouth of our father David, your servant, said by the Holy Spirit, why did the Gentiles rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers were gathered together against the Lord and against his anointed." Right? And then makes direct application to the Gentiles, i.e. Pilate, and the Jews as well, the nations. Now, as Israel would experience this, more narrowly, it also characterized the nations surrounding Israel, didn't it? And her kings found this to be true as well. We read today about the seven nations that Israel defeated, right, on her way to the Promised Land. And then all through her life, she was constantly hounded and dogged by nations like Moab and Ammon and Edom. And then, of course, eventually conquered, brought into exile by Assyria, and then later Judah via Babylon. So this would be in the coronation ceremony, once again, keeping these psalms in their context, indeed used as coronation psalms, this would be a very dramatic moment in the coronation ceremony. It would be a recognition of Israel's past, dating from the Exodus. And if you can imagine these psalms being sung, how many Levites did David appoint to the music ministry? Do you remember from last week? 5,000. 5,000. Now, these would not all be used every day in the temple service, but for big gigs like this, for coronation of a king, most or all of them would be employed. So you would have these voices singing, whether in unison or in parts, a very festive occasion, very dramatic too. Remember, I mentioned last week that indeed Israel's life was like a musical. You'd have dramatic moments moving along, and we saw last week how boring the Sound of Music. I never saw The Sound of Music until many, many years later when it came out on DVD, because I was so bored by the... I wanted some excitement, some drama. I wanted to see all those Nazis get blown away. I didn't want, for some reason, the family to begin singing in the middle of it all. But no, Israel's life was like this musical. And music was an interwoven part of their life. And everybody would sing too. So this would be a very dramatic moment in this coronation ceremony, full of music, full of drama. The coronation ceremony was intended to be this vivid drama filled, for all concerned, a combination of inauguration and musical, if you will. The wicked call his rule bonds and cords, do they not? Which must be burst and cast off. King Jesus' yoke is easy. His burden is light, is it not? Why do you chafe? There's no reason to chafe under the rule unless you hate righteousness and love wickedness. And indeed, evil men love their evil. Evil men love their wickedness. They practice it, and they scorn, and they scoff, and they chafe at righteousness and goodness, do they not? So for them, the wicked, the rulers, call his rule bonds and cords by which they are bound, which must be burst and cast off. Israel aspired to rule from the river, the Mesopotamia, in Mesopotamia, Babylon, to Egypt, right? They aspired to do this. So at a coronation ceremony, they would hope that indeed this king, finally, this king, is Uzziah going to be the man? Is Ahab going to be the man? Is Josiah going to be the man? All coronated, all hoping that indeed their kingdom would expand, finally, to the promised Mesopotamia, to Egypt. Well, whose kingdom will prevail? Whose kingdom will prevail? The nations gather together, the rulers and the kings, they plot. Do you think God is worried about whose kingdom will prevail? Whose king will prevail? We get some insight here, do we not? Suddenly we step back in this very dramatic moment. Note the remote euphemism he uses here. He who sits in the heavens, talking about God, of course. He who sits in the heavens, far removed from the taint and the effect of these silly plots of the wicked, he is sovereign, he is supreme. Keep this in mind, brothers and sisters, in the turmoil of our day. In contrast to the rage and the rebellion of the kings of the earth, the sovereign laughs. He derides. Once again, this is a contrast to the scorning and scoffing of the wicked. The sovereign, God sits in heaven, he laughs. He is the one who derides them. And he will speak a word of fury on wrath. Christ's second advent will not be little baby Jesus meek and mild. Right? So many still have that in mind for Jesus and think that's all he is, or that all is what God is, right? He will speak a word of fury and wrath. Here is foretold judgment and hell. Now, a climactic moment would occur in the ceremony, the coronation ceremony at this point. As for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. This would be the very climactic point when he would be crowned and he would take his place on his throne and indeed recognize that God has sovereignly set his king, a new king, whoever it might be, coronated now here today on Zion, my holy hill, to the hurrahs of Israel. Moses foretold the day that God would find a place of his own choosing, right? David won Jerusalem and the hill Zion, did he not, in battle? Solomon built the temple at which the king would be crowned. And here now, the man of God's choosing would walk up that hill, stand to be crowned, and then sit upon his throne. And he would be reminded of the decree. That is the covenant provisions with David. Right? I read them a little bit earlier to you. When your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring after you, who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. The hope was, Rehoboam, will he be the one to reign forever? Will it be Uzziah? No. Josiah? No. Jehoiakim? Oh, certainly not Jehoiakim. Is this that one to come from David's body, his seed, the true son of David, the son of the one who sits in heaven as well? And to this son, God will give the nations. No evangelical, many Reformed brothers of mine still have not given me an adequate accounting of how the nations will be judged. How will the nations be judged? How will the nations relate to the eternal kingdom? That is the solid sense, then, of this affirmation, you are my son. Today, that is the day of coronation, I have begotten you. That was the sense that God indeed has begotten you, like the king. Begotten you as the king. You are my son, today I have begotten you. To this son, then, God will give the nations. How is this verse then employed and interpreted by the apostles? Do you see how it is interpreted by the apostles? When you have a Jehovah's Witness come to your door and point out this verse, they try to make it sound as if somehow God or Christ was a created being because he was begotten. But how do the apostles interpret this? Turn to Acts 13 again for a moment. Very important. Very important interpretation by the apostles. Look to verse 33 of chapter 13. I pointed this out when we moved through Acts. I'm going to point it out again now. It's very important for you in your dealings with cultists. It's very important in your interpretation of Scripture. The apostles interpret the Old Testament for us, and we need to interpret the Old Testament in the way the apostles do. Okay? We can do this. It's not rocket surgery, is it? Verse 33 of chapter 13. Once again, this he has fulfilled, Peter says, to us, their children, by raising Jesus, as also it is written in the second Psalm, that is, about the resurrection, right? You are my son, today I have begotten you. That is, his begetting is his resurrection, co-equal with his resurrection. So that's how the apostles interpret this, and how we must interpret it as well. His resurrection is his begetting. You are my son, today I have begotten you, i.e. raised you from the dead. Okay? And we'll come back to this as often as we need to, and just underline this for you. It's very important interpretation of this text. So then, to this son, begotten, raised from the dead, God will give the nations. God will give him the nations. A thing only dabbled at by the kings of Israel, right? If this were to be true, then who would be the true king? Who would inherit the nations? How extensive his rule? How extensive would his rule be? If they only knew. If they only knew how extensive his rule would be. Do you think the apostles knew about Idaho back in the first century? Of course they didn't. Nobody knew about Idaho except those who lived here, right? But his kingdom has extended to it, has it not? He is indeed inheriting the nations. He's inheriting the nations. How is he doing it? Is he doing it like the Islamic State, by cutting off children's heads? Destroying, murdering, slaughtering, and killing? No. He's doing it with word and sacrament, isn't he? With the shalom, the peace of word and sacrament, as it nefariously and secretly and unseen transforms the hearts and minds and lives of men and women all over the world. Isn't it marvelous how God works? You don't have to cut off your head to save you. No, he works in your heart. He transforms you, brings you alive in your spirit to the living God. Does he not? That's how he works. And that's how he's conquering the world. But there will also be a larger day as well. As Revelation 11:5 says, the kingdoms of this world shall become the kingdoms of the Lord and of his Christ. And there will be a day when he breaks or dashes the wicked rebels as well. No more baby Jesus, meek and mild. There will be a day when he comes in terror and fury and judgment. Revelation 19 says, cites this text too, says, From his mouth comes a sharp sword with which to strike down the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron. He will tread the winepress of the fury of his wrath of God the Almighty. Israel at her mightiest was never able to do this. The kingdoms of the world all aspire to do this, do they not? And each coronation in Israel held out that hope that, well, maybe this one, right? Maybe this guy. All of them failed miserably. No, it is the Christ who will do this. And so indeed, there is some immediate advice then. Psalm 2 concludes with some advice, does it not? For kings, now therefore, O kings, be wise. Be warned, O rulers of the earth. This is wisdom literature stuff. You find this kind of thing laced throughout the wisdom literature as well. Be wise, be warned, rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear, rejoice with trembling. Derek Kidner says, rejoice with trembling conjures up a startling mix of emotions in the face of serving so great a king. But when you realize, even if you're in his grace and mercy, that this is indeed the king of all the earth, there is a sense in which we can serve with fear. We can serve with fear and with love and rejoice while trembling at the same time, right? To tell a king to tremble, to tell a king to fear, was to slap in the face. He's king. He shouldn't have to fear anything. He shouldn't have to tremble before anyone. No, you do before the living God. You do before this king, because he is king of kings, Lord of lords. So serve him with fear. Rejoice with trembling. We will do that one day. You know, there's a sense in which we should do that here and now. Visitor to our church once left saying, I was afraid during part of the service. I don't want to come back. They were afraid they were going to have, we talked about praying a prayer of confession, confessing our sins. He thought he was going to have to stand up and confess his sins. Well, in a sense, you do you not? When we gave the warning at the supper, he was afraid then too. Well, yeah, you should be. There should be a sense of fear in our worship, should there not? Not all happy, glad. Right? 7-11 songs, singing seven words over 11 times? No, there should be a real sense of fear in our worship, just as there is a sense of fear here before this king. Serve him with fear, rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry. What does it mean to kiss the Son? Huh? Are we getting happy-clappy again? Are we getting maudlin and sentimental? No. You showed your respect, your obedience, and your love for a sovereign by giving him a holy kiss, if you will. Kiss the ring, kiss the foot, kiss the cheek. These were all done in the ancient world to show obeisance to a superior. Kiss the Son, i.e., he is your Lord. He is King of Kings, Lord of Lords. So acknowledge this then with a royal kiss. Lest he be angry and you perish in the way. For his wrath is quickly kindled. Jesus got mad at things the disciples scratched their heads at sometimes, right? Remember when he healed on a Sunday? This is what the Son of Man is about to be doing. This is what I am called to do. Heal on the Sabbath. Is it not right to heal on the Sabbath? When he saw the Pharisees weren't looking at that, but looking rather at his obedience to their laws, he got angry, didn't he? He got angry when he preached his diatribe against the Pharisees. He got angry clearing the temple. All of these things, the disciples stood back, whoa. What are you doing, Jesus? He doesn't see as man sees, does he not? His fury is kindled quickly. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way. Indeed, no more baby Jesus, meek and mild. Well, for those who do, then, once again, it concludes with a blessing. Begin with a blessing, do we not? Blessed is the man. Blessed are all who take refuge in him. A a bidding of grace here. Take refuge in this one. He is indeed the man. He is the righteous one. For one who judges righteously and justly, for those who have been cleansed and made whole, able now to obey that law, to meditate on that law, to love that law. You can trust this one, can you not? You can take refuge in someone who is just and righteous. You will be treacherously betrayed by the wicked. But you can take refuge in this one, this King of God's own choosing. I urge you to take refuge in him while you can, while it is indeed the day of salvation. Because there is a day coming when indeed the nations will be brought to judgment. Precisely how nations will be. But you will stand before him. Now kiss the Son, lest he be angry. And that is, show your obedience to him. Give yourself to him. You can trust him with your soul. I urge you to do these things. And as you do, you'll find grace. We'll find grace now as we come to the supper that indeed represents the price he paid to make us his own, as we come to the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.